Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is July 28, 1982, and this is my audio letter number 77. Early this month, on July 6, there was an unusual news report from Russia. That day, an Aeroflot jet transport had crashed on takeoff from Moscow Sheremetyevo Airport. It was a spectacular, flaming crash that killed all 90 persons on board. What was unusual about this news item was that it was made public so quickly. Usually, plane crashes in Russia are announced more quietly, and often after a delay of hours or even days, but not this time. The Aeroflot flight that crashed on July 6 was an international flight bound for Africa. Some of the passengers were students returning to their homes in Sierra Leone and Senegal. Under the circumstances, Russian authorities had no choice but to release the news without delay. Within hours, it was included in news reports around the world. Within hours after the Moscow tragedy, investigators at the scene discovered that this had been no ordinary plane crash. In the midst of the twisted, smoking wreckage of what had been the Aeroflot plane, conclusive proof of sabotage was found. A report about the sabotage was flashed to KGB headquarters in Dzerzhinsky Square in Moscow. There, the report was directed to a special task group assigned to deal with growing acts of internal disruption in the Soviet Union. A mounting campaign to create internal turmoil in Russia is going on, created by Bolshevik agents there. So far, there has been little news about this in the West, but it's a real and deepening problem. Within 36 hours, the KGB Special Task Group was able to confirm what had been suspected. The sabotage of the Aeroflot jet had been carried out by one of the Bolshevik disruption groups, which had been under surveillance in the Moscow area. These groups, like others all across Russia, are being financed and directed by the Bolsheviks here, now headquartered in the United States. The KGB notified the Kremlin of the results of its investigation of the Aeroflot sabotage early on July 8, just 2 days after the crash. Those suspected of having carried out the sabotage were under arrest. But the question remained how to send a message to the Bolsheviks in the United States to cease and desist from similar acts. It does no good to talk to America's present rulers. Action of some kind was required, and fast. Various possibilities were discussed and rejected for various reasons. Retaliation for the Aeroflot crash had to be designed to convey a clear message to the American Bolsheviks in terms they understand. The message the Kremlin wanted to send was, "We know what you did to our plane. We have the means to destroy you and the will to use it if necessary." For the message to be effective, time was of the essence. And so, a target of opportunity order was given jointly to the KGB and the Russian Space Command. The KGB was ordered to select an American airliner for destruction within 24 hours. The criterion for selection was to be a passenger list as similar as possible to that of the sabotaged Aeroflot plane. The Aeroflot plane had carried many foreign passengers, and a total of 90 persons had been aboard. Therefore, the KGB was ordered to select a commercial airliner in the United States with similar characteristics. That is, there must be at least 90 persons aboard and an unusually high proportion of foreign passengers. The Russian Space Command would then have the responsibility of destroying the airliner on takeoff, just like the Aeroflot plane. KGB agents here in the United States had little difficulty in selecting not one, but several candidate flights. Thanks to America's cross-connected computerized airline reservation system, the task was relatively easy. The Russian Space Command was then free to choose whichever flight was most convenient to attack. As in the past, it was decided to mount the attack using bad weather as an operational cover. On the afternoon of July 9, summer rainstorms were moving in patches through southeastern Louisiana. They were the kind of thunderstorms that build up in the heat and humidity of scorching summer afternoons. It was an on-again, off-again rainstorm, locally heavy at times, then slacking off to a few sprinkles. At New Orleans International Airport, it continued to be business as usual on that rain-swept afternoon. Weather conditions like these were a familiar occurrence, and the airport was equipped to monitor them closely. At around 4 p.m. that afternoon, airport sensors detected a condition of disorganized air movement called wind shear. Warnings were broadcast to airplanes in the area so that they could take it into account. Meanwhile, flight operations continued without let-up. Rain or no rain, the weather was still far better than the minimums required for flight. As the wind shear warning was broadcast to pilots, a number of planes were preparing to take off. One of these was a Pan American 727, Flight 759, bound for Las Vegas. The pilot heard the wind shear warning and decided to take appropriate action to guard against it. The faster a plane is moving, the less vulnerable it is to shear. So when Pan American Flight 759 headed down the runway, the pilot held the nose down longer than normal. By waiting a few extra moments, he allowed the 727 to pick up extra speed as a margin of safety. Then he lifted the nose and the plane jumped off the runway and started climbing. Other planes, some of them smaller and more vulnerable to wind shear than a 727, took off before and after Pan Am Flight 759. All of them did so without mishap. The Flight 759 was destined to be less fortunate. This was the third day after the sabotage Aeroflot jet had crashed in Moscow. Pan American Flight 759 had the required load of more than 90 persons. It also satisfied the criterion of an unusually large number of foreign passengers, in excess of 20%. And although Flight 759 was a domestic flight, the plane itself belonged to America's international flag airline, Pan American. The parallels with the sabotage Aeroflot flight were judged to be more than adequate. And so as the Pan Am jet rotated upward off the runway, a Russian Cosmosphere was waiting, hovering in the clouds over the airport. A moment after the jet left the runway, it was hit by what witnesses described as a bolt of lightning, quote unquote. What they actually saw, my friends, was a surgical blast from a charged particle beam weapon. It was fired down at the jet by the Russian Cosmosphere hiding in the clouds overhead. It is not surprising that the witnesses mistook this for a lightning bolt. Whenever charged particle beam weapons are discussed in public, they are most often described as producing a sort of man-made lightning bolt. But a charged particle beam only looks like a lightning bolt. What it does is far more destructive than lightning. The beam blast was aimed very precisely at the air intake mounted in the tail of the 727. The blast blew superheated air and debris into the center engine, ruining it. The fringes of the blast also damaged and interfered with the other two engines mounted nearby. As the jet lost power, witnesses saw it stop climbing normally and start mushing along through the air. Less than half a mile from the end of the runway, the plane clipped a tree as it descended toward a crowded residential area. The doomed jetliner passed right over a woman who later told reporters, "It was spitting and popping like it couldn't get the motor running." Moments later, the dying jetliner was crashing, cartwheeling, and exploding through four blocks of Kenner, Louisiana. Stunned residents who had been narrowly missed by the crash looked across the street in horrified disbelief. Where moments before there had been neighbors' houses, there was now a firestorm. A wall of angry flames towered 20 stories into the air. All 145 people aboard the plane had perished, along with 8 more on the ground. My friends, the Aeroflot crash in Moscow and the Pan Am crash 3 days later in New Orleans were not just tragic accidents. The victims in those tragedies were casualties in the secret war between the United States and Russia. Barring a miracle, all-out war is on the horizon. And if it comes, it will come suddenly, just as destruction came suddenly to a suburb of New Orleans earlier this month. In recent days, top leaders of both the United States and Russia have started speaking openly of war. Both sides are now saying that the United States and the Soviet Union are already at war, which is true. But the secret warfare, which has been going on for years now, is only a pale shadow of things to come. My three special topics for this audio letter are: Topic number 1, the growing momentum toward nuclear war 1. Topic number 2, America's domestic shift onto a war footing. And topic number 3, the rising pitch of Russian anti-war warnings. Topic number 1. Early last month, from June 4 to June 6, the 8th Economic Summit took place between the United States and six other leading industrial nations. The summit was hosted by France with the usual pomp and ceremony. The summit was supposed to enable a meeting of minds which would result in a more unified approach to solving the world's economic problems. But the entity, known as President Reagan, went there with different goals in mind. The Bolshevik-dominated Reagan administration is preoccupied with thoughts of war and intrigue, not with building a better world. Because of this radical difference in viewpoint, Reagan was out of step with the other leaders at the summit from start to finish. It was symbolized at the very beginning when all the leaders were flown to the Palace of Versailles in the blue and white French helicopters. All, that is, except President Reagan. He refused to ride in a French helicopter, arriving instead in his own Marine Corps chopper. A matter of security, someone said. The Reagan obsession with security at Versailles verged on paranoia. For example, he took his own supply of drinking water to France aboard Air Force One. Why? Because he just did not trust French water, even the many kinds of world-famous French bottled water. Just a matter of security, someone said. The French were offended when they heard about Reagan's boycott of French water, but what really insulted them was the way he behaved toward the exquisite French cuisine at the Versailles Palace. While all the other world leaders were relaxing and enjoying themselves, Reagan was behaving as if someone was out to get him. Reagan has two members of the Secret Service who are assigned as food tasters, like those for royalty of old. He will eat nothing until they have tasted it first. If the food tasters don't die, he concludes that the food is not poisoned and eats it. When the Reagan food tasters invaded the Versailles Palace kitchens, the chefs were incensed. To question French food is to demean the very glory of the French Republic. As one indignant chef told reporters, "Our own president has no food tasters. He trusts French food." If the Reagan paranoia displayed at Versailles had been limited to matters of food and drink, it might have been shrugged off as unimportant. But the fact is that during the talks themselves, the United States was even more out of line. Our trading partner said, "Let's work out a way to bring down high interest rates, which are killing our economies." The so-called Reagan team replied, "Let's cut off trade credits to Russia in order to kill the Russian economy." The Europeans said, "We're vulnerable to economic catastrophe due to our near-total dependence on Middle East and Persian Gulf oil. A war in the region could cripple us overnight. We must protect ourselves by obtaining a second source of energy. Therefore, we must help build the Siberian pipeline to bring us natural gas from Russia." But the Reagan team replied, "If you build the pipeline, Russia will benefit too. So don't build it." As the conference broke up, there were reports in the press that the United States had angered the other nations there. Instead of working to solve our own problems, the Reagan administration was interested only in making problems for Russia. After the economic summit broke up early last month, the Reagan entourage continued an extended trip through Europe. On June 9 and 10, a summit of NATO leaders was held in Bonn, West Germany. In the final closed session of the summit, the entity Reagan gave a summary statement so warlike that it stunned everyone else into silence. European diplomats are so worried by what Reagan said that early this month some of them started telling the press about it. The controlled major media here in America have carefully avoided highlighting this ominous story. But just over 2 weeks ago, on July 11, a syndicated article about it was published by Newsday. The article begins, and I quote, "President Reagan stunned allies at the NATO summit by telling them that as far as he is concerned, the Soviet Union is at war with the United States," European officials said last week. The statement, which came as the president was summing up his views on the two-day meeting in Bonn, so surprised the other heads of state that they remained silent, and NATO Secretary General Joseph Luns immediately adjourned the session, according to these officials, who were present at the summit a month ago, unquote. My friends, for several years now I've been reporting on the secret war that is raging between the United States and the Soviet Union. Up until now, the fact that war is already underway between the superpowers has never been admitted by either side. But this is a war that cannot remain secret forever. The momentum is building toward the moment when it will erupt into all-out war, nuclear war one. And as that moment draws near, my friends, both sides are starting to speak of war in clear terms. At the NATO meeting on June 10, the alleged President Reagan said that the United States and Russia are already at war. Several weeks later, a top Russian leader said much the same thing. On July 13, Pravda published a speech by the entity Marshal Ustinov, the Soviet defense minister. As I've explained in the past, anything attributed to Ustinov carries a great deal of authority. Ustinov declared that the United States is orchestrating a trade, credit, and technological war against the Soviet Union. He also gave a blunt warning to Washington that a, quote, "preemptive first-strike use of nuclear weapons could not ensure an American victory," unquote. Ustinov's warning reflects the fact that Russia's new leaders know about the Reagan administration plan to launch nuclear war soon, and they are preparing to defeat the Bolshevik-triggered American first strike, if it is carried out. But the Bolsheviks here are not listening, my friends. As I've detailed in the past, the Bolshevik mentality is satanic and schizophrenic. Those obsessed by Bolshevik thinking are totally incapable of persuasion by normal reasoning. They see shadows, like Reagan with his water jugs and food tasters in France. They're out of touch with reality, as you and I know it. So they're plunging right ahead with their plans for nuclear war. In Audio Letter 63, nearly 16 months ago, I outlined the 5-track plan of the Bolsheviks here to lead us into nuclear war. As I reported then, all 5 tracks were designed to start coming together around mid-1982, in other words, now. And it is happening. Track 1 of the American Bolshevik War Plan called for stirring up as much internal turmoil as possible in Russia and her satellites. This is intended purely for distraction to keep Soviet authorities off balance. The most dramatic example of the ongoing campaign of internal harassment recently was the July 6 crash of the sabotage Aeroflot jet in Moscow. Track 2 of the war plan called for preparing the American people for war. That part of the war plan has gone much farther than most people realize. We're becoming conditioned to the idea that getting ready for a nuclear war is the number one priority of the so-called Reagan administration. A government which pretends to be bent on saving money is spending record amounts for military projects. At the same time, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is vigorously publicizing alleged civil defense plans. The fact is that neither the new military projects nor the proposed new civil defense measures are expected to bear fruit for the general welfare of the public. Those things take time, and the Bolsheviks here intend for nuclear war one to erupt long before that. The only real purpose of these things is to make us think in terms of war with Russia and to safeguard only the American Bolsheviks in their private war bunkers. Track 3, the Bolshevik plan to prepare for war, involves space, and in particular the space shuttle program. In Audio Letter 63, I reported that a series of 4 initial missions were planned for military purposes. The story was to be fed to the public that these would be test flights. Elaborate preparations were made ahead of time to provide falsified television coverage of the orbital portion of each flight. This was done by means of advanced videotaping. Meanwhile, the actual military activities carried out by the shuttle astronauts would not be seen by the public. As I reported in Audio Letter 63, the plan called for all four of these crashed military space shuttle missions to be completed by mid-1982. That time has now arrived, and Space Shuttle 4 is history right on time. When I recorded Audio Letter 76 last month, the fourth space shuttle mission was in progress. I can now report that its primary mission, which I described last month, was successful. The Secret Air Force cryogenic sensor system is now in geostationary orbit over the Indian Ocean. It is parked there, waiting to do its job about 6 weeks from now, but the present Pentagon schedule is maintained. That job, my friends, will be to confirm success of Stage 1 of the planned American nuclear first strike against Russia. I can now report that Space Shuttle 4 also had a secondary mission, which was not successful. It was piggybacked onto this mission in hopes of gaining additional intelligence over Russia. The laser-armed robot spy satellite, which was launched by the third space shuttle, did not last long, my friends. It did survive long enough to provide the basic new target information the Bolsheviks and the Pentagon wanted. And it also picked up some unexpected additional information close to Russia's space bases. Strange installations of some kind are being built in many places in Russia. A Russian Cosmos interceptor succeeded in destroying the super spy satellite before it could be reprogrammed to take a closer look at the sites. And so Space Shuttle 4 was given a piggyback mission. High-power surveillance equipment was mounted in the rear bay of the crew compartment to look out through the windows in the top. The arrangement was very much like what was done in the second shuttle last November 1981. The shuttle was launched initially into a minimum inclination orbit toward the equator, as I reported last month. That was done to enable the Air Force sensor to be launched with its rocket booster into its high equatorial orbit. Then to carry out the second mission, a little publicized additional capability of the space shuttle was used for the first time. At the insistence of the military, the shuttle was designed with the capability to change its orbital plane by a large amount. Space Shuttle 4 was initially in an orbit that went no farther north than Cape Canaveral. In order to do any spying on Russia, it was necessary to swing much farther north. The shuttle accomplished this by changing its orbit less than 24 hours after launch. From its initial 28.5-degree orbit, the shuttle fired its engines to achieve an orbit that took it above 40 degrees north. That was enough to take the shuttle over southern Russia, where several of the mysterious new sites are located. By that point, the space shuttle had been converted to nothing more than a giant awkward spy satellite with lasers for self-defense. But it did not work. As soon as the shuttle headed north, it was attacked and destroyed by Russian space weapons. So the Bolshevik war planners here still do not know what the rush-rush new Russian installations are all about. Even so, the Bolsheviks here consider the secret mission of Space Shuttle 4 to be a great success. Their precious attack confirmation sensor is now in orbit, pointed at Russia. The final act in Shuttle Mission 4 was carried out on schedule with great fanfare on July 4th. The final secret duplicate of the Space Shuttle Columbia swooped in to land at Edwards Air Force Base with the President watching. Afterwards, the President gave a speech in which he gave lip service to future support for NASA. But the fact is, my friends, that the Bolsheviks here believe they have no further need for space research. They believe the secret military shuttle program has done its job and that they are now ready for nuclear war one. In recognition of this fact, the entity Reagan carried out a military ceremony at Edwards Air Force Base after the shuttle landed. Major General James Abramson, who seized control of the shuttle for the military, was promoted to Lieutenant General. Abramson had nothing at all to do with developing the space shuttle, but he has guided its secret use in preparing for war. And for that, he was told, in effect, well done. Track 4 in the elaborate Bolshevik plan to lead us into war called for the introduction of certain new offensive nuclear weaponry. That task is now essentially completed, my friends. The Minuteman TX mobile ICBM missiles, which I first revealed in Audio Letter 55, are now deployed. And the stealth Phantom warplanes, which I described in Audio Letter 73, are being deployed now around Russia's borders. Track 5 of the plan called for a sudden mushrooming of simultaneous crises to provide the spark for war. And it is happening, my friends. The brutal Israeli invasion of Lebanon last month has dragged on with no solution in sight. Every time anyone suggests a way out of the crisis, the Begin government says no deal and bombs Beirut again. And now, since July 14, the Persian Gulf War between Iran and Iraq is multiplying the instability in the region. Iran's thrust into Iraq is doing exactly what Israel wants, throwing the Arab OPEC nations into disarray. The Iranian battle cry is on to Jerusalem, but up to now, Jerusalem could not be more pleased. All this is paving the way for an Israeli limited nuclear strike to destroy Saudi Arabian oil wells, a secret plan which I first revealed nearly 7 years ago and have updated a number of times since then. Elsewhere around the world, the fires are multiplying. Savage new fighting has erupted between Somalia and Ethiopia. The war in Afghanistan is heating up. And in Central America, the El Salvador war is now spreading to engulf Honduras and Nicaragua. So-called right-wing commandos from Honduras, trained, outfitted, and supplied by the CIA, are intensifying their attacks on Nicaragua. The United States is using troops and material from its Panama Canal base to help Honduras against Nicaragua. This has now placed the Panama Canal in dire jeopardy, just as I warned it would be in my book 9 years ago. During August, world crises are being planned to multiply and get rapidly worse. The Pentagon's target date for nuclear war is still mid-September, my friends, and that is just around the corner.